This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your I can't believe this is real life music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. This has been a challenging week. As I'm sure many of you know, last week, a little Peep passed away at 21 years old. Peep is someone who we've talked about on podcast before. He was part of sort of an offshoot of the SoundCloud rap movement, and also one of the people really at the forefront of bridging hip-hop and emo, pop punk, and in my mind, one of the most promising musicians really in any genre in terms of shaping what I felt like the sound of next year or the year after was going to be. Peep died on his tour bus in Tucson. The understanding from the police department is that it was drug-related, a suspected overdose of Xanax, possibly cut with other drugs, what certainly appears to be accidental. This is something that is obviously a terrible tragedy, personally and musically, and we were going to take this week off of podcast. It's a holiday week. After Pete passed, I couldn't kind of stop thinking about how I felt like I wanted to speak about him a little bit, and I felt like I wanted to hear some of those who knew him well speak about him. I want to talk about his music, and I want to talk about what he brought into pop that was so particular and so specific. We see a lot of blending of styles happening, especially in SoundCloud Underground. You know, I've written elsewhere about a guy like Nothing Nowhere who works sort of similar source material as Peep. Peep is someone who I think was extremely well-versed in contemporary hip-hop, also really understood the kind of song graph of pop punk and emo from the mid-2000s, mid to late 2000s, and found a way to make those two languages into one. And that's not something that comes easily. There are different artistic approaches, and they are different thematic worlds. The lyrical contents of the two don't always line up, but Peep had found a way to make them all sort of harmonize together. And I remember being very impressed the first time I heard those records, first time I heard especially the mixtapes from last year, Crybaby and Hellboy. they just seem to arrive fully formed. And if you go through his SoundCloud page and even just listen to various Lucy's and songs he appeared on with other artists, you just hear someone just in really in supreme control of his gift. And it's very frustrating that this is the end of the Peep story. Although undoubtedly, I think we're going to see a whole slew of artists inspired by him who hopefully will find some way to extend his legacy. I happened to be in Los Angeles a few days after Pete passed away, and so I decided to take this opportunity to spend some time over the weekend with two people, also media figures who spent a lot of time around Peep and covered him pretty extensively and worked with him. First, I was with Roger Django. Roger is the founder and proprietor of Mascarilla, which is a website that specializes in emerging hip-hop. And Roger also happened to grow up in the same town as Peep. Roger had a long personal relationship as well as a professional relationship with Peep. And then I was also with Adam 22. Adam runs No Jumper and was one of the first to post Lil Peep videos on his channel and interview Peep. And Adam is someone who has chronicled especially intensely what's been happening on SoundCloud. I'm also going to play a few minutes of the audio of the interview that I did with Peep in April. Again, I think it'll be really instructive, especially in the wake of what happened last week, to hear him speaking about his music and his motivations for making music and why he gravitated to the style and sound that he did and was so effective at it. Let's listen to an early Peep song. This is the first song from Lil Peep Part 1, which is one of the Bandcamp releases. And this is Praying to the Sky. So I'm here in Los Angeles, and I'm with Roger from Mascarilla, Roger Django. What's up, man? How you feeling today? Rough.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that.
Roger, you guys might remember, joined us on the podcast about SoundCloud rap, and Roger runs Mascarilla, which is a website that covers a lot of this music. And I guess I want to talk a little bit about you and Peep have a few things in common besides musical taste, both in the same town.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about Long Beach on Long Island and kind of its history and kind of how it led us to where we are now.
Long Beach is just a city right next to Queens, but it's technically on Long Island. But nobody reps Long Island from Long Beach. It's a little beach community that's probably not that little, but it's really cool in the summer and it's horrible in the winter because it gets so cold.
Mm.
But a lot of kids growing up there, you know, like surfing and skateboarding and listening to like Sublime and Oasis and stuff like that. Yeah.
Rick Rubin.
Right.
Is
so
from there.
Rick Rubin went to Long Beach High School, the same one that me and Peep went to. And like, yeah, that's always.
Is that a thing that people like know? Like, is it like discussed?
If you're into music, it's like everyone knows Rick Rubin and stuff. And like, it's like always, yeah, it's like the thing that I find myself talking about a lot.
Sure.
Yeah.
So how did you and Peep first meet?
So I'm a little bit older than Peep. And I was closer in age to his brother, his older brother, Oscar.
Mm.
So me and Oscar would hang out around the same people and be at the same parties. And it's crazy. I actually don't ever think I actually like officially met Gus when I was in Long Beach, because I ended up leaving and going to LA, like, pretty much right out of high school. So the first time I really saw Gus was in LA. It was in this Pasadena house that they lived with Ned Arb and Craig Zahn and Brendan Savage and Wavy Jones and Killstation and everyone with. And one of the first things he said to me was, I saw you at East End Pizza when I was like 14, and it was right after you put out like a Mac Miller interview or something, and I wanted to say hi to you so bad, but I was too scared. And this is as people's telling me, this is before he put out Cry Baby, but I just heard his songs. I'm just like staring at him like, I'm like scared to talk to you now because like you're so good. But yeah, I mean, like, that's like who he was after he got famous. People would always ask, like, yeah, like, what's he really like? Is he like some crazy like rock star? I'm like, no, he's kind of like a shy, anxious,
pretty gentle kid.
Yeah, very soft spoken, shy, anxious kid. Like, yeah, he's just like pretty much what the image is of him kind of being a weirdo. It's like, that's just who he was like his whole life.
You know, when I met him, there was like a delicateness, even though he very clearly had like all the elements to be sort of like a tremendous personality and kind of like a outsized figure. There was something like his inner soul seemed like a lot calmer than that.
Yeah, I think something that I always loved about him, and I think probably other people would say the same thing, is that you could just, me and him would just like look at each other in the eyes and like wouldn't have to say anything. Cause like, especially coming from the same town, and then, and like now we're at his show or something, it's like we didn't have to like say like, oh, this is so crazy. We would just like stare each other in the eyes and kind of like shake our heads slowly and be just like, yeah, like, so yeah, I think like that, he's just like so, yeah, so like gentle. And like, I think everybody that he knew had their own like unique relationship with him, because he was just that kind of person that like everyone had like a very special thing with him, where they probably had the same sort of like connection in like another way.
When you did finally first meet him, he had put out the 2015 tapes, not the 2016 tapes.
Right. Yeah, he had like 30,000. He had 3,000 followers, like 3,000, like no followers, and was showing me SoundCloud, and like there was like not a lot of the plays on it, but he was playing me songs that would end up on Cry Baby, and they were so good. And he was talking about his relationship with Adam from Tiger's Jaw, who's now Wicked Face, Wings Eternal, and like he was so happy to be working with him and Cold Heart on like this new like thing. And but yeah, he just got his Cry Baby tattoo like the week or like the day before that I like met him out here. And yeah, like sleeping on the floor. And yeah.
Did you find him to be ambitious musically?
Yeah, like I just feel like he always knew that he was going to be big. Like, I don't know, he just like had it in him. Like, that time I met him, I was just in my brain, I was like, oh, like he's like probably, he like might be able to do an unmatched show now, like on the Sunset Strip now, even though I know he doesn't have the fans. Like, in a month, like he's probably going to have the fans. And like, I just, yeah, like he, I feel like it's just a quiet, he would never say that loud, but if you look at him, like he knew what was going to happen.
It was striking how, even as he got bigger, he never seemed awkward in those spaces. Yeah. You know, he seemed like a person who could like work a room really well, whether it was the tiny room on Skid Row or whether it's like a fashion show in France.
It's funny, Brendan Savage, who he grew up with Peep. They are the ones who moved out here together. When he moved out here, he just showed me this video that someone has on their MacBook back in Long Beach. And it's like, apparently he didn't have a TV in his room, but he had a computer. So like his only form of entertainment was like video chatting with people and like his friends and stuff like that. And he was just like, he was like twerking, and he's like 11 years old or 12 years old or something. And he's just like dancing. I think it's to, he's dancing like Michael Jackson. He's doing like the thing where like the
Thriller dance moves.
Yeah. Like he's doing the Thriller dance moves, and it's just, yeah, I mean, seems like he's always
been in that level of comfort.
Yeah.
So when you started covering him on Masked Gorilla, did he stand out to you from even the other stuff that you were covering or the other types of records you were covering?
Yeah, he immediately stood out, and he stood out so much that I understood that he was going to rise, and me and him never talked about it online or anything, that we knew each other, because I didn't want that to like taint mm-hmm. what is my actual feelings, even if I was from like another country and I found him.
Mm.
And I mean, immediately I remember tweeting like Lil Peep is going to be a superstar and Lil Peep is going to be one of the greatest musicians of our generation.
Mm-hmm.
And the responses to that were obviously like negative at the time, because that's like a crazy thing to say. But I just remember from the first songs he played me that like I knew that this was something so new, and
mm-hmm.
he like actually really talented at singing. He's not like, he's not doing like a bad version of it. And,
right.
Yeah, just immediately, I instantly knew.
Can you talk a little bit about seeing the fan connections with him? Because I think a thing that I've been really struck by in the past few days is, you know, looking online and seeing that there are these vigils, but in all these different cities, not just here in LA,
right.
but, you know, Columbus, Ohio, and Denver. Yeah. And you can tell that the connection with fans was really intense. So what do you think was happening there? What were you seeing it up close?
So I think his connection with fans were so strong because I talked about it on the original podcast, where he's very authentic. Like, he grew up like being an outcast. Like, he, when he was younger, he would shave his head and bleach it and dye it blue mm-hmm. when he was, you know, like 14 or something. And when everyone else in Long Beach is like wearing Quicksilver and like, you know, being a surfer and listening to Sublime, he was like into like, you know, like Cameron, but also into Black Flag. And he got tattoos at a really early age. And so he was just so authentic in that he was an outcast, even in his own friend circle, let alone his own town. So when he started making music, and he was very brutally honest with his music and talking about that, it's just, I think kids can instantly relate to that. And it's kind of like liberating to listen to him talk about that. I think you were going through those struggles.
Did you get a sense that other musicians, other artists in the scene started to kind of like orient themselves around what he was doing?
Yeah, I think, well, he, you know, like, he joined Goth Boy Click, and so like Cold Heart and Wicca and MacNet were doing that before him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he also turned into like the biggest member of it, but they had an amazing crew. But yeah, I think people who weren't in his crew were mad, and I got some calls of like people like mad that like he's the one who's gonna blow up out of this whole scene that mm-hmm. we've all been in for so long. But also, you know, I think that's the hardest thing that I'm dealing with right now, is that, well, I mean, the hardest part about his music that I'm dealing with is that how I view him, like how I knew he was gonna be a superstar. It's hard that when he started getting traction, a lot of kids decided to get face tattoos and change their names and be Lil this and Lil that. And it really kind of muddied the waters in terms of like how he was a pioneer and breaking ground. And then it kind of just turned into that, like, oh, it's like a new scene where like everyone pops Xanax and is weird and has face tattoos. And it kind of, I think it like diluted his like influence at that very moment. And yeah, I think that's what's hard now, is that like, even online, it's kind of like, people never, because he never got to reach that like Prince level,
right,
or that superstar level, that no one got to see the full vision that's like in my brain and was in Peep's brain and in Chase's and everyone else's that was around him that knew.
Yeah, I mean, I think a thing that I've been thinking about a lot is, in my mind, I think I'd probably spent a lot of energy imagining the directions he would go in,
yeah,
and the records that he would make or the collaborations or whatever, or basically how that sound would start to infiltrate into more spaces, into more ears. I think it still could happen. It's just strange that it'll happen in a different way now.
No, yeah, so, like I can, I mean, before he passed and now, like, I could still, like, I see it in my, like, I know, like, what his album was going to be like in 3 years. I mean, even without ever talking to him about it, I just knew in my head, like, the heights he was going to reach. Like, I knew, oh, he's, like, whenever someone asked, like, oh, like, how's Peep doing? I was, like, I would be, like, oh, he's, or, like, they would ask me, like, oh, like, how's his career going or something? I'd be, like, no, like, you don't understand. Like, he's going to have, like, this feature next year. And, like, not even knowing that he was going to have this, but it's, like, no, trust me, it's going to, like, end up on this pop song probably. He's going to be on the radio, and he's going to be, like, the new, you know, this or the new that. And, yeah, really, like, it hurts that he never got to, like, you know, fully
reap the rewards of,
yeah, or, like, yeah, like, fully, yeah, fully reap the rewards of, like, what he built.
When you say built, does it feel to you like what he did build or what he was part of building is sturdy enough to actually continue?
Yeah, I mean, of course, and especially with all his, like, friends around him who, they helped him develop his sound, and they were influences, and he influenced them. I feel like them alone, like, they can live out the legacy. Like, but, I mean, yeah, I think, I mean, before he even passed, what, I mean, you can look at recent artists who signed to major labels, like, oh, that's a Peep clone, that's a Peep clone, that's a Peep clone.
Yeah.
Like,
it's already happening.
Yeah, like, it's going to live. It will never be as authentic, but that, yeah, it's definitely going to live on.
So there was a vigil here a few days ago. Can you tell a little bit about what that was like? It was in Echo Park Lake, not in the lake.
Yeah.
It was at Echo Park Lake. A lot of folks came out, it sounds like. It looked like, certainly on Instagram,
yeah,
like a lot of people were there.
I mean, yeah, there were a lot of people there. And,
mostly friends and intimates or also
no,
fans?
No, it was like way, I mean, like everyone was there who should have been there from friends, but there was like so many kids there. And, yeah, the visual, I was a little apprehensive to go because I couldn't, at that point I only saw Brennan because we know each other and stuff like that. And, but I was really like, I didn't know if I could handle seeing everybody, but yeah, I mean, even going there, I was like hysterically crying in the lift.
Mm-hmm.
Then getting there, but just seeing all the kids, it just, it was so incredible.
Was it kind of like reassuring and stabilizing to see all the fans? Or was that hard also?
It was hard because we just threw the show at the Echoplex. It was like the block away.
Just so everybody knows, like, you do a concert series that's part of, that's a, you know, related to Mask Girl. It's called Unmasked.
Right.
Where was the show? Was it the Echoplex?
Yeah, the show's at the Echoplex. Seeing all the kids was really hard because, like, I just saw these kids and, like,
they were faces you recognized.
Yeah, and, like, it's like, you know, like, it's weird, you know, when, like, you pull up to this concert and you see a crowd, but now it's pulling up and it's a crowd for, like, a completely tragic reason. And, I mean, and, like, yeah, like, I just was just thinking, like, this isn't how it's supposed to be. And, like, he was supposed to be in stadiums in, like, a year or two, and he was supposed to be this huge star. And, but, it was beautiful. Everyone had pink balloons and candles, and I saw his manager, Chase, and I saw, like, everybody. I saw, like, everybody that I ever knew,
yeah,
in the underground scene. And, like, people that I, like, halfway knew through the internet. But it's just seeing them all and hugging them all. And, like, we're, like, bonded together forever through this. And Magnet and Cold Heart and Fishnark from Gothboy, mm-hmm, like, pulled up in a black Benz truck with pink balloons on it. And it was, they're blasting his music and... yeah, it was beautiful. And Rain was there, his filmer from England, from London, and Hexy was there,
yep,
and it was really good to see him. And after everyone was kind of just like milling around and hugging everybody, and eventually people started talking, and his friends talked, and I spoke, and Brennan got his mom and his grandma on FaceTime, and they spoke, and it was really beautiful.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his brother, Oscar, spoke, and through the FaceTime. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, like his friends from back home are watching it through the FaceTime, and like his old main girlfriend that he wrote all the original songs about mm-hmm. was watching it. Yeah, it was really beautiful, and ended with playing his music and releasing the balloons, and people were singing the lyrics, and yeah, I mean, just like couldn't stop crying the whole time, but at the same time it was great to like kind of have that release, and it was so beautiful to see all the lives he touched, and like yeah. how everybody has their own little story, like how like I have with him, like so many people have like a similar, like how they met him, and you know how it's special in their own way, and it's beautiful to hear everyone's story. And we went to Ned Arp's house after with like a bunch of his friends, and Ned Arp is actually on the road, but he had us at his house, and yeah, it's just, you know, everyone just celebrating his life, and like all these new friends that I have forever now.
Of course.
Yeah.
How are you coping moving forward? Like, is it sort of, are you in steady conversation? You know, is it group texts? Is it phone calls? Like,
yeah, like, it's funny. Yeah, like, I was just with everybody right before I came here. I was at Peeps and Ned Arp's old Skid Row loft where, like, he moved to after Pasadena when he put out Cry Baby. He moved there for a little bit before he ended up getting his own place.
Right.
And we were all there, and Mikey Cortez and Death Beach were giving everybody little peep tattoos, and yeah, it's, I mean, it almost, like, if you don't think about it for a second, it feels like everybody's just hanging back.
Right.
Like, hanging out again, like, the old times, and, like, you know, like, we're all just, like, waiting for peep to come through the door.
Yeah. I appreciate you talking to me, man. Is there a peep song you want us to play to take us out?
I always love Driveway. I mean, probably a lot of people want to hear Lil Kennedy, but let's play Driveway.
All right. Driveway, Lil Peep.
Leave it in the driveway, this job done. Making me cry and pull out my gun. I'm gonna shoot this if you run. Blow my brains out just for fun. I can't sleep and I can't eat. The same old shoes still on my feet. The same old grass still on my lawn. But it died since you've been gone. Oh.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
I'm in Los Angeles with Adam 22. Adam, how you doing, man?
We had a couple of rough days there, but, you know, feeling a little bit more upbeat today.
I want to talk about your personal memories with Pete, but also contextualizing kind of what happened with him musically and also personally, and how that sort of how it's played out to where we are today. So can you take me back to when you were first up on him?
when was it? Did you meet him in person? Was it music? Was it SoundCloud? Like, how did you first get exposed to him?
I actually bothered to look through my DMs the other day and found the first DM he ever sent me, which was a sort of a generic, like, hey, I appreciate what you're doing for the underground type thing. And then he hit me up again asking me if I would check out a video of his that we wanted to host on the No Jumper YouTube, which at the time we hadn't really done that. And
was this like 2015 still or 2016?
I could get you the exact date from Twitter, but it's, it was I think about 2 years ago, a little over that or something. Yeah, the first video he ever sent me, and I think that Ned Arb, one of his main producers and friends, he was the reason why I actually like was alerted to it and checked it out. But as soon as I saw it, this is the darkest portrayal of drug addiction in this video. Like, this was a much darker Lil Peep at this time before he sort of went in a little bit more of a melodic direction. Like, at this point, even the music was extremely dark.
So Come Around, you hosted, you premiered. This is a very, like you say, this is a very different Lil Peep.
And I mean, I remember one of the earliest conversations I had with like my girlfriend at the time or something. I showed it to her and I was like, this is one of the weirdest rap songs I've ever heard. And the portrayal of it in the music video in particular. And she was like, that's a rap song? Which is, that's the conversation that people have always just had around Peep. It's like, is this rap music? How is this rap music? But I mean, this video in particular with Come Around, it was just... and the darkest, slowest production, and it was just, I don't know.
When you talked to him around this time, did he conceptualize himself as a rapper? When he would talk about his music, was he like, this is rap music?
I'm not sure I ever really had conversations about that at that time. By the time I interviewed him was a bit over a year ago when him and Lil Tracy were in full effect together.
Right.
So, I mean, I think at that time, you know, he certainly was presenting himself alongside other rappers. He was presenting himself in the context of other rappers, but you know, it never felt like he had any sort of reason to hold himself back to try to be more of a rapper.
Yeah.
And not to just make the... And I think if you look at his music the whole time, I mean, that's sort of the story of his stylistic innovation, is to be able to really just sing on beats in the sort of like, you know, emo type croon and to be able to still be considered a rapper.
Yeah, he had like a very particular way of approaching kind of like how to put syllables together that was indebted to both rapping and singing.
Right.
I feel like sometimes like we'll talk about someone who like raps like a singer or sings like a rapper. When I hear what he was doing, he was synthesizing those things in a way that really had not yet, at least to my ears, had not yet really been done. He understood how those two things could kind of live side by side.
Yeah, and he to me, was always just somebody who was so dead set on living his own way and being himself. I don't think that he ever considered compromising that. And at the same time, if you listen to his most, you know, faded 4 o'clock in the morning freestyles with Chapo and Agoth, there's one in particular, and just all these ridiculous, you know, things that he would do just completely out of his mind on drugs at 3 or 4 in the morning. Like, that's one thing that took me back, because I was listening to some like really deep cuts from his SoundCloud and stuff that like Chapo and just other people in GBC were reposting, is that he had so much of something to say and everything felt so important, even on his most throwaway tracks that he probably freestyled in somebody's living room.
Yeah. What did you feel about him as a lyricist and as he developed like into the sort of like Hellboy crybaby phase?
I feel like for him, it was just a constant process of figuring out who he was. Mm-hmm. And we got to see it play out so publicly. And, you know, even like him, as he began to be more open about his sexuality and everything. I mean, I think it was like the same process of him realizing like, oh, I don't have to dress like other people. I can wear the craziest stuff. I don't have to, you know, worry about getting a tattoo on my face, regardless of like, you know, how crazy some of the tattoos were. It was just this constant process of finding out that he wasn't held back by any like conventions of society. So, but it always seemed pretty, you know, linear and unsurprising to me. Like I 100% expected him to go in those directions in a lot of ways. If anything, I was just surprised by the fact that he was so open. That, that like in a lot of ways, the change that I want to see in rap music was like epitomized by him because he was, you know, so free to experiment sonically with his style of dress, with his sexuality, with everything. Like, you know, he was just held back so little. And that in a lot of ways, I think is like one of the main things that we want to see from rappers in this day and age, myself in particular. And he was really at the front of that, the pack on that.
You don't even know what I've been through.
Did you experience him as fragile? Because I experienced, you've spent much more time with him, obviously, but I experienced him both as vulnerable in the sense of sharing himself, but also fragile. And I wonder if you saw that more up close or if that's something that resonated for you.
I saw him as like a people pleaser. Like there were stories that people at his memorial that I went to the other day were telling about how, you know, he would have 20 people in his apartment and he couldn't bring himself to tell anybody to leave because he just wanted, you know, he just enjoyed having people around, even if they were, you know, complete and total enablers and people who were didn't necessarily care about him that much. Like, he wanted people around. He wanted to make people happy. In terms of him being fragile, I mean, you know, I wonder that. Like, that's – I can't say anything definitive. That's something I wonder is if he was using the drugs to cover up, you know, the fact that he was unhappy and the fact that he was unsure of himself or unsure of things in his life. Or did he just get caught up in that at some point and just keep going with that side of life? Like, I mean, the tragedy of the whole thing is that, and even when I first heard that he overdosed, it was like, oh, well, a lot of people overdose and then they're all right. And that's how they learn their lesson. When I saw that he overdosed, that's immediately like the only consolation I could give in my head. Like, okay, like maybe he'll clean up his act.
There will be a positive turn.
Maybe this is a positive thing. And that not panning out and like being taken so early is just, I don't know. I think it's making everybody in the rap world, hopefully to a certain extent, take a look at themselves and how they're living their life. And like, not even specifically with drugs or with specific drugs in particular, but just
the whole thing,
living recklessly as possible, you know, because it's not like he was just doing drugs. He was doing drugs that a fan gave him.
Right. Which is a totally different,
you know, it's the kind of behavior that I know tons, probably most rappers to engage in, which I've done it too. And it's crazy.
You posted on Instagram, you know, you basically said something to this effect on Instagram yesterday or the day before. In the conversations that you've had with other rappers since Peep's passing, like, do you sense that it's more than you who's concerned about it? Do you sense other artists actually being concerned about it?
I've heard that conversation coming up a lot. And even, like, you know, I seen Uzi tweeting about saying that he's trying to get off Xans and stuff, which I don't even know if people knew that he was on it like that. I definitely didn't know that he was using Xans that much, but I mean, I've had that conversation with a bunch of people and a bunch of like people saying to me about other rappers that I know, like, do you think that they're going to feel comfortable talking about stuff? To me, it does feel like I now have like more pressure on myself to, like, as a person who's kind of been around the block, seen the ups and downs of drugs and stuff. He's like, maybe I need to be more literal with how I talk about this stuff to kids. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm sure a lot of rappers are feeling the same way. And I don't think you can just, I mean, there are certain rappers that when I think about it, they present like an image of drugs that never shows the consequence.
Of course.
And that's a really shameful thing to me. Like, like great rappers or great performers talk about drugs and show both sides of it. And I mean, hopefully we could see that and see less of like the straight up glamorization.
Also, I think in the social media era, the drug use gets decontextualized. Like, it looks, it's made to look glamorous. Mm-hmm. And if you're experiencing it primarily through your phone, you think, oh, those people seem like they're having a great time.
Yeah.
And so that's, you're not living it. You're just, you're sensing it.
Yeah. And let's just be upfront about it. You know, Peep basically documented everything leading up to him passing on Instagram. And I mean, the same photo of him with the Xan breaking down on his tongue is that might have seemed really sexy to a bunch of kids who really don't know shit out there. And like, I mean, whether he likes it or not, I mean, we have to reckon with the fact that that kind of behavior specifically is leading kids in a bad direction. And we need to be more honest and upfront about that stuff.
Do you think that part of the struggle of this scene in particular is that really everybody is so young?
Exactly.
Because I mean, you're out here, you're of a different generation. You're here with these kids, but you're of a different generation. But the kids, they're genuinely kids.
For sure. I feel like in a construct like the podcast, the true nature of the discussion about drugs is usually allowed to emerge.
Yeah.
But then when you're just doing something for Instagram, you just Snapchat. When some kid does a Snapchat of them taking a Xanax or something, it seems funny and you know, you don't get any kind of like real information about
right, there's
it.
No nuance
yeah,
to it.
None. It's totally removed to that.
So, I mean, when you think of like you moving forward, like, do you feel like you'll be more careful in terms of like how that stuff gets represented? Or do you feel like as a member of the media, you got to represent it as it's actually happening, even if it's ugly?
Yeah. I mean, there's always that back and forth. Like, you know, if tomorrow some rapper came in here and like, you know, wanted me to film him taking some crazy amount of drugs, it's like it would feel very different now. And I mean, I've been feeling that way in general because, to be honest, like, I'm 33, but I've never been around people who drink lean like the way I am around people now who drink lean.
Yeah.
So even though I've totally engaged in that behavior as well, it's like I've been going through that of like realizing like, holy shit, a lot of these people that I like looked up to are drug addicts, and like I'm partially complicit in, you know, glamorizing that, which to me, it's like I'm so new to like being around that kind of stuff in a lot of ways that it is like it's a learning process for me, too. And I always will deal with that struggle, though, because it's like I want to be the rawest documentarian of this scene or this culture. And it's like if I do leave out, you know, I think about when I used to read bodybuilding magazines and they wouldn't talk about steroids.
Right.
You know, when I was a kid and I would, you know, and I knew there was something missing.
Yeah. You know, when I was working on the story a few months ago, I felt like I had that same tension where I was like, I'm literally in the room with Pete. And like the first thing he did within 3 minutes of me running tape is took Xanax.
Really?
Oh, in front of me. Yeah. And obviously, when we're on tour, you know, it's like we're out there with Perp and Pump, and there's a lot of that going around. And, you know, journalistically, I'm like, well, I can't stop this.
Yeah.
You know, there's not, I'm watching. But also, like, it's hard to write about that in a nuanced way.
Right.
It's hard to write about that in a way that's like, I'm acknowledging that this is happening, and also I can't do anything about it, but also this is worrisome.
Right.
Because these are kids.
But, and you feel like a broken record because it's like, how boring is the drugs are bad for you conversation?
And also, how many times have we had to do it?
Exactly.
You know, what happened with Peep reminded me a lot of what happened with Yams.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really eye-opening to try to write about that in a way that's true to the kind of spirit and color and energy of the scene, but that also says drugs are bad. Kids, like, drugs are problematic.
She said, "I'm crying, baby. I can't be out late. Girl, you drive me crazy. AMG Mercedes, speeding down the highway, looking at the street lights geeking on a Friday. I can never sleep right knowing I hurt you. I don't deserve you. I should have curbed you.
to ride too. I wanna die too. We all wanna die too. I got this vibe, I swear she love getting high too. I love getting high too. I wanna hide you. How did I find you? I'll be inside, I'm making music to cry too. Oh, it's a lonely world, I know.
I don't know. I'm still kind of like mulling over how exactly I want to talk about Pete publicly. Like, this is the first time I talked publicly about him, I guess. And yeah, I don't know. It's like, I mean, even in recent memory, like you have Fredo talking about, like, you know, he ended up in the hospital, Fredo Santana, and he, you know, was talking about how he's done with lean and everything, and who knows how real of a promise that was and stuff. So it's not like this is the first reminder. It just might be the most in your face for the recent generation, because I mean, these kids don't know about Pimp C.
Right.
You know, they might know about there's a guy named Pimp C who died, but you know,
they don't understand the impact of it. They don't know how painful it was when it was actually happening and how people had this same kind of conversation
and
when Pimp died.
Lil Peep's fan base largely probably didn't even know about ASAP Yams, or at least didn't understand the context of what happened with him.
Right.
And I also, I
and
mean,
that was only 3 years ago.
Right. Yeah. And also Yams dying from lean, quote unquote, is like something that people denied in the media. You know, it's like when someone does die while using lean, it's a lot harder to say that was the sole cause of it. Whereas in this case, I mean, people are airing out the girl who supposedly gave it to him on Twitter and stuff. I mean, this is more, I'm not sure that it is as cut and dry as people are presenting it, because I mean, obviously nothing's for sure. But I mean, the narrative that people are presenting seems pretty
convincing.
Pretty convincing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I weirdly, like, after my obituary posted, I got emails from a couple of MDs who were like, technically, you can't die of a Xanax. It's like almost impossible to die of a Xanax overdose. They're like, you can die of Xanax mixed with, it can create the circumstances to make it easier to die. Mm-hmm. Like, but like, technically, like, ODing on benzos is like not a thing.
It doesn't really,
right, it doesn't really happen.
Yeah, my sister works in a detox, though, out back in New England, and she told me that taking like Xanax or things that end up being fentanyl, that that's like incredibly common with what she deals with as well. So, I mean, yeah.
Did you have a sense of how big he was kind of on the verge of becoming?
To me, yeah, because when I look at him, it's like everything, and that honestly, it worried me sometimes when he would put out certain songs that I would be like, oh my God, like that might be the huge hit, because sometimes I would be scared that the media would start to like perceive him in a different way and try to turn him into a cartoon. And I wanted him to have like a nice long trajectory of like building up a real cult fan base before he had a crazy hit, because I didn't want to see him become like a joke or like, you know, something where, and that's one thing I was saying to you earlier. I was like, it almost kind of, it was like a really happy surprise for me when I saw the critical community take him seriously, because in a lot of ways, out of this whole SoundCloud scene, he was the first person that was talked about that way. Like when Pitchfork did the article about him, like I was like thankful, like, oh my God, I'm so happy that people are taking him as seriously as I do, because in a lot of ways I felt like there was like a risk that people might, and there were like plenty of critics who, you know, looked down upon him as a, you know, a person who was doing, you know, a sort of a parody of emo music instead of a person who was just like deeply influenced by all this music.
Right. And it's very striking, because I feel like the way that criticism tends to work, like the community, there's a lot of groupthink in criticism. So sometimes it takes one person or one outlet or one thing to just like crack through.
Right.
And then people will take it seriously. But it takes a lot. Like, that first thing can sometimes take a long time. Right. And he'd been putting out music for well over a year before that first thing came out.
Stylistically, he doesn't share a lot of the similar traits with a lot of people that kind of are of his generation of, you know, similar SoundCloud rappers. You know, you look at somebody like Lil Tracy, who he worked with so much, and, you know, they sort of like built like a certain style to themselves for a while, and all the Goth Boy Click guys, really. And that was another thing that I just thought was, I was always just sort of, you know, interested to see when that one song would come through, because to me it was so obvious that if he did have like a top 10 hit, that then he would be the guy who was on a poster in every little girl's room in some bizarre way, like as dangerous as he looked, like with the tattoos and everything. I still, it just occurred to me, like, this guy is, you know, and then when I really started to see it too was when all of a sudden he's with Bella Thorne all the time and stuff.
Yes.
And I started to, I've never seen anybody from this generation of like SoundCloud rappers like date a real celebrity. Yes. And stuff. And I started to be like, oh my God, like he's going to be embraced. Him when he was on the runway, yeah. I started to be like, oh my God, like he looks perfect on the runway. Like this is going to be, like he's going to be gigantic because he can do all of these things.
Yeah, and like even like that Mario Testino photo shoot, like that came out not that far after the piece that I did. I was like, oh, this is, his entree into these other spaces is actually very clean.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's like a gorgeous young man. He has created a character for himself where he is sort of like radiating this kind of energy. And that's going to make a lot of sense in fashion, in celebrity spaces. Like, that's going to be easy.
He radiated energy for sure. And like, but that was the one thing about him that I always loved is that he wasn't self-centered at all. Like if you look at his SoundCloud, there are so many reposts of his friends' songs and of random Future songs that he liked. And like, you know, random, somebody would get a feature from one of his friends and he'd be reposting that. And like in that one interview that didn't come out that I'm in the process of having somebody transcribe because the audio is all messed up, he basically, like, I was having a hard time even getting him to acknowledge the enormity of how fast he was blowing up. And he just really wanted to turn the attention to, you know, his friends, the other guys in Goth Boy Clique. He wanted to talk about Horsehead and Wicked Phase and not himself. He wanted to heap praise on Tracy. And, like, even after all that him and Tracy went through, you know, he still never unreposted the songs on SoundCloud of Tracy, like the stuff they did together and stuff. And he was just ultimately at the end of the day, like we were saying earlier, like a lot of these guys in the scene have, you know, done or said things that makes it kind of hard for you know, certain institutions journalistically to get behind them or whatever. Peep at the end of the day was one of the sweetest kids I ever known.
Yeah.
And I mean, I really don't know of him ever having done anything nasty to anyone, really. I just, all my experiences were him. I never had a conversation with somebody where they were like, Lil Peep was a jerk.
He was,
I didn't really have that conversation.
He had very clearly a gentle spirit. He moved, you could tell him just even the way he moved through rooms. Mm-hmm. Like he wasn't haughty. He wasn't arrogant. Mm-hmm. He had a softness to him.
He did.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that shined through a lot. Like he's out here looking a certain way and like making all this crazy music and everything. But at the end of the day, like he was just a kid. And I don't know. That's what I always come back to. I just keep repeating that in my head. Like he's just a kid.
Just a kid. Hey man, thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Appreciate it, man.
What's a song you want to go out on to listen to?
Oh, you know, the one that I've been listening to the most is Better Off Dying.
All right. Let's close out with Better Off Dying, Lil Peep.
Chains on shining.
So I had the good fortune to spend some time with Peep in April while I was reporting the SoundCloud rap story to interview him before his show, to see his show at Webster Hall in the Marlin Room. Peep was someone who was extremely astute about his music, understood the context for it, the influences that he was taking in, and also, I think, intuitively knew that that particular blend would have an effect on people. I think he understood that pretty clearly. I listened back
to the whole interview in preparation for this. And we had a really wide ranging conversation. We talked about his upbringing, talked about family, talked about personal struggles, and also drug use and how drug use had interwoven with his music making. As I mentioned in the story, you know, he took his Xanax within the first couple minutes that we were in the room together. I mean, this is something that he was making a part of his everyday life, which is difficult. It's difficult to think about. Now that we've heard Roger and Adam talk about Peep, I want to give you a few minutes of Peep talking about Peep, and particularly Peep talking about music. He was incredibly engaged and curious about music. And as I listen back to this section of the interview, you can hear the joy and the enthusiasm in him talking about the music that he was influenced by and also the music that he was looking forward to making. So here's Lil Peep in his own words.
Which sort of wave of bands was like most meaningful to you?
Probably pop punk and emo.
Yeah. So like kind of like on the My Chem side or like Under Oath or like
both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So that like from like mid like late 2000s.
Yeah.
Like scream emo. Like,
yeah. From the corniest ish, like the least corniest ish. I love being corny.
Do you feel like? Did you used to go to Warped Tour at all?
Yeah.
That was a very special time for Warped Tour, I thought.
Yeah.
Because I feel like Warped Tour, like when I was younger, was like, kind of like, bro punks, kind of. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then it changed, like, in the mid 2000s, it all kind of changed.
Yeah.
So when you and were you raised on hip hop as well? Like, was that always sort of around?
Yeah, New York, so a lot of that.
So you're on 97 kid?
Yeah. On 97, yeah.
Yeah.
And it turned into Power 151 when I was like a teenager, because I'm really young.
What are you, 20 or 21?
I'm 20, yeah.
Yeah. But at the time you were listening, it was mostly Southern stuff, I would imagine. That was like the real pop English.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And 50 Cent.
Right. Well, yeah. Always 50 Cent. So when you started making your own records, what made you want to start making records?
I discovered this underground scene, first through this group called Radiquan, and then through Radiquan, I just sort of discovered like this whole scene.
So you were a Perp fan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I discovered this whole scene on SoundCloud and YouTube and streaming sites.
And what was it
one
about?
One of the biggest groups, Sesh Hollow, what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, I heard them and I saw them during the day making money. Yeah, they said their lyrics, that they made all the shit, their rhymes and shit. And you can kind of tell. And it just inspired me to do it myself.
Mm-hmm. What was it about Space Ghost Perp and Raider Clan, like about those kids what was it about the music connected to you?
It was dark. I also like 3-6, you know.
That's all 3-6, like the children of 3-6.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was all internet, like everything was online. Like there's no, because that's just not on the radio, obviously. Yeah. So you're just getting it all online.
Yeah.
And so when you first started making records, did you think of yourself as rapping, or did you think of yourself as like?
Oh, my first like songs I recorded were like, I was
like
rapping.
Just straight rap songs.
Yeah, bars. Nice spinning bars.
Right.
And then I started to sing because I realized that was what I liked to do more. Mm-hmm. And that was what was better at, actually. I mean, it just made way more sense, you know mm-hmm. what I mean, for me to be. I could express myself better.
Do you think even now you're a better singer than a rapper?
Yeah, of course.
Really?
Yeah.
It's interesting because when I listen to your stuff, I feel like, I guess I understand why you would say that, but I also feel like a lot of singers,
I mean, I never had vocal lessons or anything.
No, sure. But I feel like your comfort with like rapping cadences and like how rappers relate to beats is how you sing.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and that to me is not typical when you envision where you're going to be 12 months from now, 2 years from now. Like, do you want to be at that level of ubiquity where everybody knows you?
Yeah.
You want that?
Yeah.
Like, you're not trying to, like, slow go it. You're trying to, like, just Yeah. And you're comfortable with that?
Yeah, perfectly fine with that.
And that's our podcast this week. Thank you for listening. If you want to hear more of Lil Peep's music, you can go to soundcloud.com/Lil_Peep. And if you want to listen to every podcast ever, they are all archived at nytimes.com/podcast. Drop us an email. Tell us what you're thinking about Peep and his music and the scene that he was a part of at podcast@nytimes.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio app, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer doing yeoman's work on a holiday week is Pedro Rosado at Headstepper Media. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week. Don't stutter, slang from the gutter, got bang for your butter, get my name from my mother.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.